Gathering the Dispersed Nauvoo Saints, 1847 to 1852, by William G. Hartley. The widely scattered Nauvoo Saints made their way progressively toward the Salt Lake Valley, following President Brigham Young, who on July the 24th, 1847, identified the valley as the long-foreseen right place. Theirs was a Nauvoo Exodus wedding. Emily Abbott and Edward Bunker became bride and groom on February the 19th, 1846, with Elder John Taylor of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles officiating. A few weeks after the wedding, Elder Taylor crossed the Mississippi River to join the winter exodus of about 3,000 Latter-day Saints from Nauvoo, Illinois. Emily and Edward left in May during the larger spring exodus of about 10,000 Latter-day Saints, stopping midway across Iowa at Garden Grove. There, they and another newlywed couple bought a log cabin minus doors, floor, or window. In June, Edward hiked west 140 miles, where he was one of the last 16 recruits to enlist in the Mormon Battalion. During the winter of 1846-47, Emily was expecting a baby in Garden Grove, while husband Edward was marching across Arizona with the Mormon Battalion. For ease of listening, the names of present-day U.S. states are included. The church, like the Bunkers, was widely dispersed. The saints had been forced from Nauvoo and scattered like the pieces of a broken china plate. Scattered saints. By the time spring 1847 arrived, the 14,000 members who had fled the Nauvoo area were located in numerous groups across the western United States. The main group was encamped along the Missouri River at Winter Quarters, Nebraska. In addition, two groups of saints were waiting to gather to Zion as soon as the church identified its new home. More than 10,000 converts in the British Isles and some 238 saints in Northern California who had traveled from New England on the ship Brooklyn. As the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles observed, at no period since the organization of the church on April 6, 1830, have the saints been so extensively scattered. The goal of the Twelve was to locate the isolated, large, productive place where the church was to be reassembled. They faced four urgent tasks. 1. Send an advance exploratory pioneer group west to find a route and the settlement site. 2. Subsequently, send large pioneer companies to establish a settlement at the site. 3. Have the saints who are waiting to go west develop good temporary farms and homes. And 4. Gather the widespread groups of saints. Two groups arrive in California. Surprisingly, during 1846 and early 1847, two Latter-day Saint groups arrived in California months before President Young left winter quarters for the Rockies, the Brooklyn Saints and the Mormon Battalion. Saints on the Brooklyn, wind-puffed white sails instead of dusty white wagon covers, helped one group of saints go west by sailing around South America's Cape Horn and up to California. On February the 4th, 1846, the same day Charles Shumway ferried across the Mississippi River from Nauvoo, starting the church's exodus west, the ship Brooklyn sailed from New York Harbor. On July 31st, 1846, these saints, led by Sam Brannan, reached Yerba Buena, present-day San Francisco, a village of about 150 residents. Though many stayed in California, in time about one-third migrated to the Intermountain area and rejoined the main body of the church. See Voyage of the Brooklyn, Ensign, July 1997, page 16. The Mormon Battalion. Having nearly 500 men enlist in the Mormon Battalion in July 1846 for 1 year of Mexican war duty was both a blessing and a hardship for the church. Much of the battalion's early pay and uniform allowances went to the church's general funds and helped the saints in and near winter quarters. But the loss of 500 strong men left many families in precarious circumstances, hindering the trek westward. President Young gave the departing battalion a prophetic promise, however. He said that, on condition of faithfulness, they would be spared from battle. Their expedition would result in great good, and their names would be handed down in honorable remembrance to all generations. About 80 women, children, and youths accompanied the battalion, working as laundresses and military aides. The battalion's trek across the western United States would be one of history's longest infantry marches. The Mormon Battalion first marched from Council Bluffs, Iowa, to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. They then followed the trader's well-worn trail to Santa Fe, New Mexico. There, Colonel Philip St. George Cook assumed command. Cook's orders from General Stephen W. Kearny, commander of the Army of the West, were to march the battalion to the Pacific Ocean, making a wagon road in the process. In places they had pioneered a new route through previously unexplored deserts between mountainous Apache strongholds on the north and the Mexican frontier settlements on the south. This route would become a key link in a proposal for a southern transcontinental railroad. This, in turn, would make the 1853 Gadsden Purchase necessary, bringing what is now southern Arizona and New Mexico into the United States. Of the 496 men who left Fort Leavenworth, 335 reached California. Most of those who did not make it to California had become physically unable to continue marching and had to be sent in sick detachments, along with most of the women, children, and youths, to winter at Pueblo, Colorado. When the battalion reached Southern California in January 1847, they learned that the war was over and that California belonged to the United States. Assigned to garrison duties at San Diego, San Luis Rey Mission, and Los Angeles, most of the battalion men counted the days until their enlistment expired in July 1847. In San Diego, Company B men spent off-duty hours working at their trades, including brickmaking. Within 2 months, they had built 2 brickyards, a kiln, courthouse, and chimneys, dug several wells, and performed carpenter, blacksmith, and leatherwork, which won the friendship of many residents of San Diego. When release day came in July 1847, 79 soldiers accepted Army pleas to re-enlist, but 239 went north to San Francisco, determined to cross the Sierra Nevada and head eastward to find their families. When word came from President Young suggesting they consider staying to earn money in California, 56 took jobs near Sutter's Fort. Some of them were among the first to discover the gold that launched the California Gold Rush. Others worked elsewhere. About 70 battalion veterans went eastward in 1847. Private Edward Bunker and 31 others, for example, reached and then left the Salt Lake Valley in mid-October 1847. And despite deep snows, arrived at Winter Quarters, Nebraska, in mid-December, penniless and destitute, after being gone for 18 months. "I found my wife, Emily, in quite poor circumstances," Edward Bunker recalled, and he met his 11-month-old son. By the early 1850s, most of the Mormon Battalion men had joined the Saints in the mountains of Utah. As promised by President Young, the Mormon Battalion was spared from battle. However, 23 men, 2 women, and 3 children, all Latter-day Saints, and 1 non-LDS soldier, died as a result of exposure, exhaustion, or illness. The following chart shows the locations of the widely scattered Nauvoo Saints in the early spring 1847. The approximate numbers and the location. Approximately 5,000 in the main group located at Winter Quarters, Nebraska. Approximately 5,000 in cluster groups. located at Pottawatomie Lands in Iowa, across the river from winter quarters. Approximately 450 three-wagon companies located at Ponca Camp, Nebraska, 120 miles north of winter quarters. Approximately 600 temporary settlers located at Garden Grove, Iowa, a temporary LDS settlement and resting place. Approximately 700 temporary settlers located at Mount Pisgah, Iowa, a temporary LDS settlement and resting place. Approximately 500 individual families located in scattered locations in eastern Iowa. Approximately 200 individual families located in northern Missouri. Approximately 1,500 Nauvoo area exiles and new converts from the U.S. and Europe, located in St. Louis, Missouri. Approximately 335 in the Mormon Battalion, located in Southern California. Approximately 300 Mormon Battalion sick detachments, about 80 women and children with the battalion, and the Mississippi Company of Saints, located at Pueblo, Colorado. Far southwest of winter quarters, Nebraska, two other Latter-day Saint groups ended up wintering in 1846-1847 at today's Pueblo, Colorado, the Mississippi Company of Saints and the sick detachments of the Mormon Battalion. While Nauvoo was being evacuated, leaders instructed members in the south to come northwesterly and to join them somewhere on the Platte River. In late March 1846, Alabamans under John Holliday and Mississippians under William Crosby formed a company of some 60 persons. Guided by 25-year-old John Brown, a Tennessean and former missionary to the South, they headed to Missouri, where they were joined by 16 other members, some connected to the Southerners. The group, which came to be known as the Mississippi Company of Saints, then set out on the Oregon Trail and arrived at Grand Island, Nebraska, unaware they were already 170 miles west of President Brigham Young and the growing settlement at winter quarters. Thinking President Young was west of them, they trekked onward to today's Laramie, Wyoming, where they learned that the Saints had stopped to create winter quarters. Needing a place to winter themselves, they accepted a mountain man's invitation to accompany him 300 miles south to Pueblo, Colorado, arriving in early August. There, as many as 15 mountain men and their Spanish or Native American wives and families headquartered. The Southerners fixed up their own lodgings and prepared food for the winter. One traveler observed these Saints on August 20th and said, "After half an hour's riding, we saw the white wagons of the Mormons drawn up among the trees. Axes were sounding, trees falling, and log huts rising along the edge of the woods and upon the adjoining meadow. As we came up, the Mormons left their work, seated themselves on the timber around us, and began earnestly to discuss points of theology, complain of the ill usage which they had received from the Gentiles, and sound a lamentation over the loss of their great temple of Nauvoo." In September, John Brown and six others headed back to the south to get additional family members. On the way home, they met the nearly 500-man Mormon battalion, whose leaders had come to feel encumbered by the over 80 women and children accompanying the battalion, and hampered by some seemingly unrecovering sick battalion soldiers. When battalion leaders learned that 275 miles west at Pueblo was headquartered the Mississippi Company, the news was received joyfully. Within 4 days, many of the women and children were sent to Pueblo with the first of three sick detachments of soldiers. Ultimately, about 154 soldiers and nearly all of the women and children with the battalion joined the more than 70 wintering Southerners to form a community of over 300 Latter-day Saints. Surprisingly, this group in Pueblo was some 520 miles southwest of President Young and the Saints back at winter quarters. No one knows what would have been the sad outcomes for those with the Mormon Battalion had not the Mississippi Company of Saints been so fortuitously located in Pueblo to receive care for, and nurse their incoming brothers and sisters. During their fall to spring stay there, they build a church for worship and socials, and at least 9 deaths, at least 7 births, and 3 marriages occurred in this Colorado branch of the church. Next spring, an advance party of 17 from the Mississippi Company went north in April and waited for 2 weeks at Fort Laramie before greeting President Young's advance exploratory company on June the 1st, 1847. The rest of the Mississippi Company and those associated with the Mormon Battalion, who had wintered at Pueblo, soon moved north to Fort Laramie and reached the Great Salt Lake Valley 5 days after President Young. These pieces of the scattered church became part of the whole again. The 1847 Advance Exploratory Company. Fervent prayer started President Young's 1847 Advance Exploratory trek from winter quarters to the Salt Lake Valley. Norton Jacob wrote of the events of April 16th. After being numbered and formed into 2 lines in a circle, all kneeled down, when Brother Brigham addressed the Lord by prayer and dedicated the mission and all we have to the Lord God of Israel. Their fundamental mission was to precisely locate the site that had been revealed to President Young in a vision, a site in the Great Basin, in the top of the mountains. See Isaiah chapter 2, verse 2. This advance exploratory group led by President Young was not a typical Latter-day Saint train with tight food supplies and families planning to be settlers. Rather, this was a hand-picked scouting group of 143 men, 3 women, and 2 children. 8 of the 12 apostles were in the group. To speed their journey, the company would use more horses and mules than oxen, differing from later companies heading west. In accord with a January 14, 1847 revelation, see Doctrine and Covenants, section 136, President Young organized the saints carefully into companies of 100, 50, and 10, meaning people in this case, not wagons. He served as company president and main captain, aided by 2 captains of 100, 5 captains of 50, and 14 captains of 10. Their story is one of organization, foresight, and discipline, wrote one historian, saying that they stopped more days for Sabbath worship than for delays caused by travel hazards. For half their journey, this advance exploratory company followed the north side of the Platte River. Later travelers joked that the lazy Platte was 1 mile wide and 1 inch deep, too thin to plow, too thick to drink. As much as possible, they followed somewhat established trails, smoothing and improving the way for following pioneer companies, and only occasionally blazing new trail segments. During this trek, men were assigned as hunters and fishermen. Blacksmiths were essential, constantly fixing wagons and wheels and shoeing horses. It was later written, as soon as camp was formed, Brother Alfred Lamson's forge would be prepared, and the ringing of the anvil was heard until nightfall. On April 18th, a clerk's inventory tallied 72 wagons, 66 oxen, 89 horses, 52 mules, 19 cows, and 17 dogs. The wagons carried stockpiles of flour, sea biscuits, dried beans, bacon, dried beef, salted codfish, and salt. Cows provided milk. Wagons contained tents, saddles, iron for horseshoes, nails, leather for harness repairs, and for boots and shoes, tools, cooking and eating utensils, sacks of garden seeds and buckwheat, and bags of corn, oats, and bran to feed the livestock. By late April, the wagons left behind Nebraska prairie lands and entered the high, dry Great Plains, where short, curled buffalo grass grew, and where, in the coming month's heat, travelers' lips chapped, and wood wagons and boxes shrank and cracked. Streams and firewood became scarce. Being in buffalo country, we picked up some dry buffalo dung, which made a very good fire, wrote Howard Egan, Another group member wrote that he could stand on his wagon and see more than 10,000 buffalo. During May, hunters brought in badly needed buffalo meat, which William Clayton described as very sweet and as tender as veal. What meat they didn't eat, they dried around campfires and tucked into their wagons. Fearing Indian attacks on May 4th, the captains ordered that wagons roll 4 abreast that day. During travels on May 6th, scouts rode back and stopped them in consequence of the prairie being on fire ahead. The next day, Howard Egan wrote, "Last night, the Lord sent a light shower, which put the fire out and made it perfectly safe to travel." Gathering the Dispersed Nauvoo Saints, 1847-1852. In western Nebraska, each group of 10 took turns leading the company so as to divide the chore of breaking the road. President Young and Elder Heber C. Kimball of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles often rode ahead to look out the route. In mid-May, William Clayton, trying to tally the miles traveled by counting rotations of a wagon wheel, wanted an odometer, a gear device with graduated cogs. Other wagon trains had used them. He promoted the idea. Science-oriented Elder Orson Pratt helped design it, and mechanic Appleton Harmon constructed it from a feed box and scraps of iron. Clayton attached the odometer to a wagon axle. Using odometer readings, explorer John Fremont's maps, and his own daily observations, Clayton published a trail guide a year later that proved useful to subsequent Latter-day Saints and others heading west. In late May, the pioneers pushed past impressive rock formations in western Nebraska. Carved by wind and rain, the formations looked like buildings, earning them names like Courthouse Rock, Jail Rock, Chimney Rock, and Scott's Bluff. On May 29th, while they were camped at the Nebraska-Wyoming border, President Young called a meeting and chastised some of the men for too much evening dancing and card playing, quarreling, crudeness, levity, loud laughter, yelling, put-downs, profanity, and unholy attitudes. There was not enough prayer and good reading. His repentance call produced markedly improved camp behavior. In fact, taken as a whole, these men were decent, orderly, unselfish, and loyal to each other. On May 31st, a good hard road brought the Advance Exploratory Company, now in mountain country, to their first timber and firewood in 3 weeks. By then, they were averaging 12 miles per travel day. On June 1st, President Young's 46th birthday, the travelers camped near Fort Laramie. There, 4 events broke their normal routines. First, at the fort, they gained information about the trail ahead and acquired some supplies. Second, they met 17 members from the Mississippi Company of the Saints who had wintered at Pueblo and then had come to Fort Laramie 2 weeks before President Young, where they then joined President Young's company. Third, word came that 600 to 700 wagons of non-Latter-day Saints were westbound from St. Joseph, Missouri, headed for coastal Oregon and California, and would soon catch up with the Latter-day Saints who preferred to travel alone. Fourth, starting on June 3rd, the Advance Exploratory Company crossed over the Platte River to join the Oregon Trail. Near Casper, Wyoming, the Advance Company spent 4 laborious days recrossing the Platte River, which was unusually swift at this time. Carpenters built a ferry boat by connecting 2 canoes with planks. It was capable of carrying 1 wagon. President Young assigned 10 men to stay behind to operate the ferry and earn money for the church from the oncoming Oregon Trail travelers. Leaving the Platte, the company marched overland to reach their next lifeline of water, the Sweetwater River. During June's final week, the company followed the Oregon Trail along the Sweetwater, Often the road was sandy, the landscape barren. Hunters found antelope, but no buffalo. Pioneers interacted with Oregon-bound companies, each group sometimes helping the other with repairs or blacksmithing. One day, the advance company covered 18 miles, another 25. On June 27th, they rumbled over the Continental Divide at South Pass, a gentle saddle, 7,550 feet above sea level. They camped at Pacific Springs on the west side of the pass. On June 28th, the advance company reached the important fork in the road where the California Trail and the Oregon Trail divide near Green River in Wyoming. The Saints veered left toward California. That evening, by the Little Sandy River, they met legendary mountain man Jim Bridger, the first known white man to see the Great Salt Lake. He expressed doubt that corn could grow in the Great Salt Lake Valley because of the early frosts. 2 days later, on June 30th, Sam Brannan, leader of the Brooklyn Saints at San Francisco, arrived. Among other things, he tried to convince President Young to bring the Saints to coastal California. Over the next few weeks, many of the advance company became sick from an unknown illness, suffering pain in the head, back, joints, and bones, hot flashes, chills, and sometimes delirium. For them, riding in jolting wagons was torture. On Sunday, July 4th, a dozen Mormon battalion soldiers from Pueblo caught up with the Advance Exploratory Company. Another 140 battalion members, they said, were 8 days behind them with the rest of the Mississippi Saints. On July 7th, the pioneers crossed a brook-ribboned grassy valley floor and stopped at Fort Bridger. Then only two long log houses and a horse pen, with several Native American lodges nearby. Howard Egan traded two rifles for 19 buckskins and three elk skins for making moccasins, indicating that the company's boots were wearing out. Leaving the California Trail, President Young directed the group southwest along a crude, hardly used trail that headed more directly toward the Great Salt Lake Valley, the site President Young wanted to reach. On July 10th, they crossed the Bear River Divide, 7,700 feet high, the highest point on the Mormon Trail. At the present Utah-Wyoming border, the advance company camped by an impressive formation of jutting tapioca-textured rocks, called by some the Needles. Advance company splits into three groups. On July 12th, because so many were ill, President Young asked Elder Orson Pratt to take a vanguard party of 25 wagons and 42 healthy men to hunt out the road. Their job was to clear the trail of thick willows, rocks, and brush for the coming wagons. On July 14th, Elders Heber C. Kimball and Ezra T. Benson of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, together with Lorenzo Dow Young and Howard Egan, hiked up on the top of a high mountain and offered prayers to the Almighty God in behalf of the sick and for our dear families. But by July 19th, President Young, pale and emaciated with fever, could not go on, so 8 to 10 wagons stayed behind with him. The rest moved ahead. Thus, the advance company was divided into three groups: Elder Pratt's vanguard group, the main group, and the rear guard with President Young and other ill saints. On July 19th, Elder Pratt and John Brown of the vanguard group climbed a mountain near East Canyon and became the first Latter-day Saints to get a glimpse of a portion of the Great Salt Lake Valley. The next day, the group cleared the way over Big Mountain and Little Mountain. On July 21st, they found the year-old Donner Party Trail, which passed over an exceedingly steep and dangerous hill. Elder Pratt wrote of the site, "Mr. Erastus Snow and myself ascended this hill, from the top of which we saw a broad open valley, at the north end of which the broad waters of the Great Salt Lake glistened in the sunbeams. We could not refrain from a shout of joy, which almost involuntarily escaped from our lips." Continuing on, Elder Pratt and Erastus Snow entered the Great Salt Lake Valley and explored it for the day. By the evening of the next day, Thursday, July 22nd, both the Vanguard Group and the main company were camped on Parley's Creek, at present-day 1700 South and 500 East in Salt Lake City. On the morning of Friday, July 23rd, they traveled to a site between present-day Main and State Streets and 300 and 400 South, where they dedicated and consecrated the land to the Lord and began plowing at noon. That same day, the rear guard was still in the mountains. Elder Woodruff, with President Young lying on a makeshift bed in Elder Woodruff's carriage, reached the summit of Big Mountain. There they could see, for the first time, a small part of the Salt Lake Valley, the southwestern portion. Of that occasion, 15 years later, President Young said, "I directed Brother Woodruff to turn the carriage halfway round so that I could have a look at a portion of the Salt Lake Valley. The spirit of light rested upon me and hovered over the valley, and I felt that there the saints would find protection and safety, and that darkness which had rested over every place where we had been in the States vanished altogether." The rear guard of six saints camped that night at Little Mountain. President Young enters the valley. The next day, Saturday, July 24th, the rear guard traveled the remaining 6 miles through Emigration Canyon. Elder Woodruff and President Young came into an extensive view of the valley. In his diary of that day, Elder Woodruff wrote, "This is an important day in the history of my life and the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. On this important day, after traveling from our encampment, we came in full view of the great valley or basin of the Salt Lake and land of promise held in reserve by the hand of God for a resting place for the saints upon which a portion of the Zion of God will be built. We gazed with wonder and admiration upon the vast, rich, fertile valley. Our hearts were surely made glad after a hard journey from winter quarters of 1,200 miles. Thoughts of pleasing meditations ran in rapid succession through our minds while we contemplated that not many years that the house of God would stand upon the top of the mountains while the valleys would be converted into orchard, vineyard, gardens, and fields by the inhabitants of Zion, and the standard would be unfurled for the nations to gather there." President Young expressed his full satisfaction in the appearance of the valley as a resting place for the saints, and was amply repaid for his journey. Elder Woodruff later said of that moment on the 24th, "President Young was enwrapped in vision for several minutes. He had seen the valley before in vision, and upon this occasion he saw the future glory of Zion and of Israel, as they would be, planted in the valleys of these mountains." When the vision had passed, he said, "It is enough. This is the right place. Drive on." President Young had reached the appointed gathering place for the scattered saints. At about noon on Saturday, July the 24th, 1847, President Young and the rear guard joined the pioneer encampment near Main Street and 300 South. This location marked the end of the 1,300-mile Mormon Trail. For the next 22 years, this general trail served as a major highway on which some 70,000 Latter-day Saints came to Utah until the Transcontinental Railroad replaced it in 1869. Encamped on the open valley floor, these travel-weary Latter-day Saints enjoyed a Sabbath's day rest. Then, Monday morning, they continued plowing large fields and garden plots, again diverting creek water onto the hard soil to soften it, just as the men the previous Friday and Saturday had done. They planted buckwheat, corn, oats, turnips, peach trees, apple trees, cabbage, and potatoes. On Wednesday, July 28, President Young and other members of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles appointed the site for a temple in the fork where the creek, City Creek, branched. This action of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles was the crowning step of their journey, putting in motion all that was needed to build again a house of the Lord as they had in Nauvoo. The bulk of the battalion soldiers and Mississippi Company from Pueblo arrived in the valley on July 29th. Counting them, President Young reported, "We number about 450 souls." Regarding these battalion men, Private John Steele made this observation, "Our men now looked like mountaineers, sunburned and weather-beaten, mostly dressed in buckskin with fringes and porcupine quills, moccasins, Spanish saddles and spurs, Spanish bridles and jinglers on them, and long beards. Receiving a hearty welcome and a God bless you from the Lord's ministers was worth all we suffered." Surveyors soon laid out the city, divided it into 135 10-acre blocks containing 8 house lots, and designed a grid of wide streets and 3 public squares. In August, the Salt Lake Pioneers cut logs and poles in the canyons, constructed brush-roofed bowries for shade, and built small houses of logs or adobe. To covenant anew to build the kingdom, all were rebaptized in a pond behind a small dam in a creek. On August 9th, baby Young Elizabeth Steele, named after President Young, was the first birth in the settlement. And on August the 11th, little Milton Thurlkill from the Mississippi Company drowned in a creek, the first death. The Quorum of the 12 Apostles had identified a route for the saints to come west and located the place held in reserve for them. Now they would seek to anchor the settlement in the Great Salt Lake Valley with large pioneer companies coming from winter quarters. In fact, the big company of 1,500 saints, led by elders Parley P. Pratt and John Taylor, had already left in June 1847 and were on the trail. They would enter the Salt Lake Valley during September and October 1847. Return trek to winter quarters. In mid-August, nearly half of the pioneers of the Salt Lake Valley commenced their return to winter quarters, Nebraska, nearly destitute of provision. The returnees left in groups, anxious to get their families and bring them back to the Salt Lake Valley. On August 22nd, leaders held a conference to ratify some decisions. Those in attendance approved that workmen build a common fence around the farm area, and that the settlement be named Great Salt Lake City of the Great Basin, North America, and named the Valley River the Western Jordan. Raise all you can and live in the stockade were parting instructions. Elder Kimball urged settlers to throw away selfishness, for it is of hell. On August 25th, Elder Wilford Woodruff recorded with some pride, "We have laid out a city 2 miles square and built a fort of hewn timber drawn 7 miles from the mountains and of sun-dried bricks or adobes surrounding 10 acres of ground, 40 rods of which are covered with blockhouses, besides planting about 10 acres of corn and vegetables. All this we have done in a single month." By August 26, 1847, all 8 apostles who were with the advance company, including President Young, left in a company bound for winter quarters, Nebraska. They were eager to report to the saints that the long-prophesied site for the Latter-day Israel in the top of the mountains had been located, and their new headquarters was already being built up. By early September, the eastbound returning pioneers met and passed the westbound big company of 560 wagons. Upon reaching winter quarters on October 31, 1847, the returnees found that the thousands of saints camped on both sides of the Missouri River were meeting the task of establishing temporary homes and farms. "They have raised a crop equal to any we used to raise in Illinois," President Young noted, "mostly corn and garden produce. The brethren in this region have been much more healthy this summer and fall than ever in Nauvoo." And he said of the saints there that all their exertions tend to their removal westward. Late in 1847, the 12 apostles felt to reconstitute the first presidency, which quorum had been vacant since the death of the prophet Joseph Smith. So the 12 called a special conference, for which workmen soon rushed to complete a large log tabernacle on the east side of the Missouri River in Miller's Hollow. The tabernacle was described as commodious and the biggest log cabin in the world. In that tabernacle on December 27, 1847, President Brigham Young and Elders Heber C. Kimball and Willard Richards were sustained as the church's first presidency. This action again concentrated major administrative leadership in the hands of three apostles instead of all of the 12, and it freed members of the 12 apostles for assignments away from headquarters. The next spring, each member of the first presidency led a large pioneer company from the Winter Quarters Canesville area to the Salt Lake Valley. Meanwhile, the remaining saints, who made up the majority of those living in Winter Quarters, moved east across the Missouri River to Canesville, Iowa, leaving Winter Quarters, Nebraska, all but destitute of inhabitants. High risk first year. Knowing whether or not the Great Salt Lake Valley settlers could produce a reasonable first harvest in untested land was essential to the church's future. Until the summer of 1848, the pioneers would have to rely on food and equipment brought in their own wagons. The ingenuity of every man was taxed to the utmost, said John Steele. By September 1847, the Great Salt Lake Valley settlers had built a block-square fort with adobe walls 7 feet high, and everyone had built cabins within the walls and moved in. Surprisingly, by then, some of the July-planted corn was in tassel. While President Young was gone, John Smith, the Prophet Joseph Smith's uncle, served as the Valley's stake president, assisted by counselors and a high council. These men were the Valley's spiritual and civic leaders. Under their direction, workmen expanded further the size of the original fort a block north and south. The original fort became known as the Old Fort, built hundreds of log cabins, fenced their city to control livestock, and constructed roads and bridges. They plowed some 5,000 acres and planted 872 acres with winter wheat. Mormon Battalion Captain James Brown, who had ridden to California with Sam Brannan, returned, bringing government pay for battalion men who had wintered at Pueblo. Valley leaders then sent Captain Brown back again to California with some of these funds, where he purchased and brought back cows, mules, wheat, and seeds. The population of our city is 1,671, Valley leaders reported on March 6th. The number of houses, 423. That winter was surprisingly mild, but by midwinter, hunger became a serious problem. Many are literally starving, John Steele said as 1848 opened. Leaders rationed provisions. We had about half a pound of flour per day for each person, Jesse N. Smith recalled, who was age 13 then. I was exceedingly hungry. For months my desire for food was not satisfied. Residents ate crows, thistle tops, bark, and seagull lily bulbs. They gathered wild onion and thistle roots, which, A.G. Allen wrote, were not pleasant, but hunger made them taste good. Cabin life in the fort was primitive. Mary Isabella Horn said the first log houses were small and lacked doors, windows, and floors. The ground was full of snakes, which used to crawl around our houses, but these were soon killed or frightened away, Sister Horn recalled. The timber was so full of bugs that it was years before they were entirely subdued. The mice also were very numerous, running over us by day and by night, and destroying considerable clothing. By next May 1848, the long-awaited farm and garden plants sprouted. Barley, oats, rye, buckwheat, and other grains looked good, Elder John Taylor reported to President Brigham Young on May 22nd. Flax, and especially peas, looked very promising. But by month's end, the desperately needed crops were suffering from frost, lack of water, trampling by cattle, and crickets that came by the thousands of tons. Many of the settlers became discouraged. The great cry is to California, and great fear that we shall not be able to support ourselves, Steele noted. When crickets began destroying their crops in early June, the saints prayed vigorously for help. For 2 weeks, The crickets voraciously ate garden crops and corn plants before seagulls arrived. Gulls are native to the area, but winter in California. John Steele recorded that gulls feasted on crickets during June for about 3 weeks. By July, gulls and summer heat had diminished the cricket menace, and new plants grew. On August 10th, the Saints celebrated their first harvest with a Thanksgiving feast. Leonard Harrington wrote on October the 24th, "Our wheat turned off tolerably well, though the crickets injured it considerable, as also our corn, beans, vines, etc. We have enough to subsist on till another harvest, and some corn to spare." The first presidency, a year later, in 1849, assessed that the experiment of last year is sufficient to prove that valuable crops may be raised in this valley. They sent Elder Ezra T. Benson of the 12 and Elder Jedediah M. Grant of the 70 to oversee the migration. "We wish you to evacuate Pottawatomie County, and next fall be with us," the first presidency urged the Saints. "There is no more time for the Saints to hesitate," they cautioned. "We have been calling to the Saints in Pottawatomie County ever since we left them to come away," they reminded. "What are you waiting for? Have you any good excuses for not coming?" "No." In response, in 1852, most of the Saints pulled out of Keynesville, Iowa, and surrounding settlements. Keynesville was renamed Council Bluffs. Deeper in Iowa, most Saints vacated the LDS settlements of Garden Grove and Mount Pisgah, both established in 1846. Some 10,000 Latter-day Saints were on the trail west in 1852, twice as many as in any other year. However, record numbers of other American pioneers, about 60,000, thronged to California and Oregon that year also. Stretches of the trails were jammed with wagons, and many good campsites were clogged. Some LDS branches moved as a group. Branch President Benjamin Gardner, for example, led 241 North Pigeon Branch members and 45 wagons west. In that group, Sister Eunice Allen had to choose between staying with her husband, who had become disaffected from the church in 1841, and going west with her married children, including son Jude Allen. When she asked her husband one last time to come to Utah, he declined. Poignantly, she turned and went into the house, where she rolled up the few clothes she had, put her shawl around her shoulders, and walked out to the wagons. She climbed into Jude's wagon, never looking back. Inflows of former Nauvoo Saints to Utah from Iowa during 1852 essentially closed the major chapter of the Nauvoo Exodus story and ended the wide-scale and long-term scattering. Most former Nauvoo area residents who felt loyalty to President Brigham Young and the church in Utah had moved west by then. Within a 6-year period, church leadership had done a remarkable job of reassembling the vast majority of the fragmented and dispersed church membership. They had met well the challenges that they had faced when forced to leave Nauvoo in early 1846. Edward and Emily Bunker, like other members separated in 1846, were now among the reassembled Saints living in one of the more than 100 settlements in Utah. The Great Salt Lake Valley location, in the top of the mountains, was the right place for the church to survive, build another temple, gain strength, prosper, establish procedures to gather modern Israel, and bring up new generations who would truly take the restored gospel out into all the world, preparing a people who will in time ready themselves for yet other important fulfillments of prophecy. End of the article. Gathering the Dispersed Nauvoo Saints, 1847-1852, by William G. Hartley.